This is Engineering Journeys.
Welcome to Engineering Heroes, a podcast that presents the incredible engineers that are shaping our society and battling our challenging issues. My name is Mel, and joining me is Dominic, my co-host and our podcast's resident engineer, speaking to us from the trenches. This is the final episode in our World Engineering Convention mini-series. The conference is taking place in a few days in Melbourne, and it's going to be huge. We can't wait. The convention is uniting the global engineering community, and everyone will be focused on identifying sustainable development challenges, taking action, and committing to change.
Our guest tonight is a mechanical engineer who graduated from the University of Western Australia, and who is also an adjunct professor there. About 12 years ago, he started his own company called Close Comfort, which you will hear more about shortly. But essentially, he's on a mission to develop portable air conditioning technology that provides comfortable cooling using 80 to 90% less power than conventional air conditioning. He's an absolutely prolific writer. He's written two books, The Making of an Expert Engineer, and most recently, 30 Second Engineering. He has also given a very successful TEDx talk in 2012 and was awarded Western Australian of the Year in 2018 under the Professions category. Our guest tonight is James Trevelyan.
Simply put, James always wanted to be an engineer.
I had this fascination with machines, and I loved trainsets, and then I loved Meccano, and I kept on building things. So it never crossed my mind that I would be anything other than an engineer.
Did you know about engineering as a young boy?
Oh, I did, definitely. In fact, a family friend was the professor of mechanical engineering. So he persuaded me in the end to study mechanical engineering rather than aeronautical engineering, which I was intrigued with at the time.
and that was a very wise
piece of advice.
So what was the first project when you came out of university? What was the first project that you worked on?
I worked on a Tornado, multi-role combat aircraft that was being developed by Britain, Germany and Italy. And it's funny, you know, having said that I had been advised not to study aeronautical engineering,
yeah.
I really appreciated the value of that advice because I found I was in a firm of electrical and computer engineers and I was the only mechanical engineer on staff, which meant that I was forgiven for all my naivety about electronics and circuits. And no one questioned my judgment when it came to mechanical engineering.
Excellent. And so you, the Tornado is an aeroplane?
It was. You know, it's really fascinating. You start out your career designing a new aircraft. And I had this weird experience 2 or 3 years back in China trying to find an English language TV program to watch at the hotel. And it was a documentary about how these aircraft were being taken apart and scrapped.
Oh, no. Oh.
Yes. But the materials being recycled.
It was good to see. It's the whole life cycle, though.
And I looked at it. I said, yes, I designed that bit. You know, I never actually saw the real thing because it was built quite a while after I did my design work. So I only ever saw sort of mock-ups and things like that.
So you're an engineer straight out of university and you are designing components that go in a fighter plane.
Correct. Yes.
Wow.
In fact, my job was really all about human factors. Our job was to ensure that the pilots and the other air crew could actually operate this incredibly complicated machine that was full of computers. So it was a very challenging job. It's hard for other people to appreciate just how demanding that job can be. If you can imagine being driven on the roughest road imaginable and having to concentrate on little tiny bits of information on a computer screen in front of you, it's worse than that.
Exactly. No, so you, as you said, the human interface.
Yeah. It's still an amazing job to be doing first out of university.
It's important to understand that as an engineer, you do get thrown in at the deep end and you sometimes end up doing fantastic things and sometimes you end up designing footpaths.
Yep.
And both can be incredible learning experiences.
Yes, you got to take what you can out of it.
Over your career, what's been the most interesting job that you've worked on or the most challenging project?
I think the one I'm on now. Perhaps in two ways. Yeah. So, I mean, the aim of what we're doing is to bring air conditioning to everybody on the planet. I started with a real human need. In fact, I was spending a lot of time in Pakistan in the summer because I just love the mangoes there. And the electricity supply was not coping with all the air conditioners plugged in. So they started switching it off in the middle of the night for an hour or two. And lying in bed at 40 degrees centigrade indoor temperature with mosquitoes lining up for their aiming run was not a pleasant experience. So I said, well, let's just see. Is it possible to have a battery-powered air conditioner that would run through those regular power cuts? And that's where it started. And it was there's always this idea that there was a real human need there. The importance of that is that ultimately you can only bring these innovations to lots and lots of people if there's a market and people can afford to buy it.
It's very true. And it's that value, that intrinsic value in it that actually makes it so important.
You know, if you look at countries which are hot and humid, where there are vast numbers of people living, South Asia, 2 million people, only a small percentage have access to air conditioning. And yet, air conditioning is almost a survival necessity in many cities. You know, cities have this urban heat island effect. So whatever the temperature is, it can be several degrees hotter in the city itself. And if you're living in an apartment block, you don't have the option of going downstairs when it's cool.
No.
And so this is why air conditioning is such an essential service now in so many countries. But we can't use existing technology or else we will literally cook the planet. Mm. So that's been the challenge, is to find a way of doing it. And the other aspect is this. It really surprised me to find out that engineering services and products are actually far more expensive in countries where we think it would be cheaper.
All right.
So we always think about manufacturing going offshore to countries with low labor costs. But actually, with those low labor costs comes very low productivity. And the result is that things are actually much more expensive when you specify the same quality, durability, and design. And that was the big puzzle for me. Why?
Mm.
Because engineers get paid less, so you know, and labor rates are low, so it should actually be cheaper. But it's not. It's hideously expensive. And the most extreme example is safe drinking water, you know, which is typically between 70 and 120 US dollars for 1,000 liters in South Asia, because it has to be carried. That's the biggest component of the cost.
Right.
And yet here in Australia, it's typically $3 US for 1,000 liters.
Because it can be transported.
Because it comes through the pipes, and the pipe system works, you see. And yet, so it's a real puzzle as to why pipe water systems don't work in South Asia. And it's not just water. It's electricity, construction. Everything you can imagine is actually more expensive once you specify the same design, the same quality. And trying to understand that was perhaps the most challenging aspect of my whole career. The two projects are combined, obviously, because, you know, we're talking about bringing air conditioning into the same environment, and we have to find a way of doing it in a very cost-effective way so people can afford it.
Mm. I don't think people realize just exactly how much of a difference it makes. I mean, it opens up vast areas. It means that cities can develop and move and spread into areas that would have otherwise been uninhabitable. And yet there is that whole balancing of the energy that's required in order to power air conditioning systems, which is doing, you know, can create such damage to the environment at the same time. So how do you get that balance in what you do?
Well, that's a good question. You know, air conditioning is not just a question of energy, particularly for the moment, the CO2 emissions associated with that. It's refrigerant gases are extremely potent greenhouse gases.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's been recognized in the Kigali Agreement. We do actually have an international agreement to phase out the worst of the refrigerant gases. But ultimately, the idea is to use far less gas, far less machinery to bring comfort to far more people. And that's required lateral thinking. And the basic idea is to cool people, not buildings.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
very simple if you look at it. But the idea is not to waste energy cooling bricks.
Yep.
Definitely. And is that what your company Close Comfort's all about, individual cooling as opposed to building cooling?
Yes, it is.
I am curious about the architectural responsibility in this kind of cooling system. where because air conditioners have come along so far, it's created this standard of design that windows don't open because that'll keep the coolness in or the heat in or things like that. And there's losing touch of the natural way of cooling. So, for instance, I know a story in India where somebody's now putting in those cool wells in the middle of the home, or I can't remember what they're called, but like a water source in the middle of the home, which actually helps cool the home naturally. Do you feel that has a role to play?
Definitely. You know, this is called vernacular architecture. Okay. Architectural designs that go back millennia.
Mm.
But, you know, there is a difference. Vast numbers of people now have no choice but to live in cities, in tall apartment blocks, which have been built. And they have no option. They can't you can't convert an apartment block into a 10th century house with a wind tower. There's just not enough space to do that. And the climate is warmer. The surroundings are warmer. We have to find elegant solutions for today. Yes, vernacular architecture, of course, has its place. We should learn as much as we can from that. But we have to move on and say, we've got a problem. We have to solve it now. And we can't go around rebuilding all our cities. We don't have time.
I'm so glad I asked that question, because that brings it. That's exactly true.
Yeah. And it's also a case of, I feel strongly about the fact that there was a lot of resources that went into play to build that building in the first place. So just bowling it over and then starting again means that there's so much more energy that has to go in and so many more resources that need to be created. So if you can create elegant solutions utilizing what you have now, then it's going to be far more beneficial than sort of trying to start again and bowl it over and try and design it right this time, as it were.
Well, imagine trying to rebuild Australia in 25 or 30 years.
Well, it would be a great economic boom for a short amount of time. It was a good comment. I like what you just said then about, this is not exactly what you said, but that you have to live with the past mistakes, if you will, but you need to, like Don was saying, the elegant solution to resolve them and to improve upon it. I like that. Let's just take a short break here before we delve into James's hot topic, which will be all about questioning the real value of engineers. Now, if you're loving what James is talking about so far, I will have links to his company and his blog in our show notes, and you'll be able to see him speak live at the World Engineering Convention in Melbourne. Have you got your ticket yet? This is our final episode for the World Engineering Convention 2019 mini-series. Dom and I will be speaking about some topics that have come up in our podcast at this event. And if you can make it, come and check us out live. Our details are on the website. But for now, let's get back to James as he delves more into understanding the value of engineers.
It's most unfortunate that we're really poorly regarded in governments, boardrooms, C-suites, around the world. And this is understandable if you stand back and look at our performance. Large engineering projects over $1 billion, we have to understand that the success criterion is that the investors get just half of what they were promised. Only 1 in 3 projects succeed. 1 in 3.
Wow.
And 1 in 6 will be completely scrapped. Zero value. People walk away leaving a pile of scrap metal, which is quite often literally cut up and carted away. Now, it's not a statistic that engineers feel very comfortable about. And many engineers with whom I've discussed this say, oh, it's a management issue. You know, it's project management. That's the problem, not the engineering. But it's important to accept that, first of all, the people who run these projects almost invariably are engineers. They might be classified now as project managers, but they have been engineers, and that's their background. And number two is that the people who pay for these projects see them as engineering projects. They don't distinguish. They just simply say, well, it's a waste of money to invest in engineering. And if you think about it for a moment, we have historically low interest rates. This should be an environment in which engineers are flat out building.
Sure.
There has never been a time when you can borrow money so cheaply and invest it in engineering. The reason why interest rates are so low, part of the reason, is because investors don't trust engineers. And that is something we have to fix. And it's not a matter of fixing a reputation. It's a matter of fixing performance first. In order to address the reputational issue, we have to improve our performance. I think the best way I can explain it is by telling sort of very typical story of what would happen in an interview with an engineer. I go along to an engineer and I say, I'd like to interview you. And the engineer would say, but, you know, why? What can I tell you? I say, well, I want to understand what engineers really do. And then they would say, but why are you talking to me? Because I hardly ever do any engineering. That's it. What do you mean by that? When you are doing engineering, what is it that you're actually doing? And very often the reply would be, say, well, you know, calculations, design, that sort of stuff. And of course, the only time I can do it is after everybody else has left the office and the phone stopped ringing. As often as not, I'll do it at home. I say, well, what about all the other stuff? I said, well, that's just administration, contracts, meetings, you know, emails, endless correspondence and paperwork. And I'd say, well, that's all non-technical stuff, right? Yeah, yeah, it's all non-technical. So then why can't you hire an assistant, you know, administrative assistant to do all that? Oh, yeah, but you can't because you've got to have the engineering knowledge to know what to do with it all. Right. So it is engineering work if you need to be an engineer to do it.
I understand it, yeah.
Yeah, but it's not real engineering work, if you know what I mean. And that is the essence of the issue. Mm. So as engineers, we need to accept that it is real engineering work, and we need to learn how to do it. And it's not non-technical. It's highly technical. But it's this perception that it's non-technical, which is an enormous barrier. And what I'm suggesting is perhaps the most interesting bit of work that's come out. After asking the question, what do engineers really do? The next logical question was, why do they do what they do? And equally important, why do they not do what they don't do or push to one side? And so that is all to do with value perceptions. Because as people, we tend to do the things which we think are going to create the most value, the most intrinsic value. And value is a very fuzzy word. It has lots of different meanings. But if you like, one way is to say, well, I'll do the things which I think are going to create the most satisfaction around the place, keep people happy. And what I've discovered is that engineers' ideas of what creates value are at sharply different from business owners. And that's where some of the problems start to creep in. What our research shows is that the majority of engineers can't actually explain why the work they do is of value. So therefore, their work is not well regarded because it's not necessarily contributing value. The fundamental issue is that engineering students don't learn how to create value. And that's not surprising because there hasn't been a theory to explain it until recently. I got an invitation to write a chapter in a book which turned out to be written by a bunch of philosophers, and I suddenly realized in a panic, oh, I've got to be really careful about my arguments here. And I started to really research the literature, and particularly in economics. And one of the things that you realize is that in engineering, there's this pervasive idea that you're only really doing something valuable if you're innovating.
Yes.
Now, you only have to look at Create, the Engineers Australia magazine that comes out monthly, to see this. Where the vast majority of articles are talking about something new at the leading edge of technology. It's all about innovation, innovation, innovation. Now, the fact is that the vast majority of engineers are not allowed to innovate.
Yes.
Because the client says, if it hasn't been done before, find another way that has.
Yeah, I don't want to bear the risk of something that's unknown.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. So the question arises, well, if engineers create value through innovation, and the vast majority of engineers don't innovate, then why is it that they get paid at all?
Yeah.
So you lead to a sort of economic contradiction. And in resolving that contradiction, we found some very interesting answers. So we've published that work since, and I'll talk a little bit about it at the convention, but it's available on my blog and website, and we've put out a couple of publications so anybody can find it.
I really like the point that you made in regards to sort of happiness versus value, in that what we think is value, we sort of default to making the client happy. But in reality, making the client happy isn't necessarily going to add value. And coming from my side of the fence in regards to the building industry, more often than not, the client just wants the cheapest thing to get him or her across the line so they can submit the documentation. Whereas I think engineers are very bad at presenting themselves where you sort of need to stop and say to the client, hey, I understand that, but by the same token, if you listen to me, I can show you how you can build that building for a lot less money than what people are telling you that you're going to be able to build that building for. And I suppose it's a little bit of a sliding doors moment where you need to try and show them that by utilizing your services and actually taking your technical knowledge, which is what they're paying for, they're paying for your expertise, and so that they can realize that they're going to have less problems down the track and produce a higher quality, better building, for example, than they would if they just sort of got what they need to get it across the line and sort of fill out the forms and just do the administrative paperwork so that they can submit it and get the builders on site and ready to go. And it's a very hard one for the engineering fraternity themselves, because we need to look at ourselves as an industry and realize that, I think. Do you find that that's what's going on with engineers, that it's more along the lines of they're not seeing their value?
We haven't got time to go into a full exposé of problems in the Australian building and construction industry.
Oh, no, that's very true.
Very, very high-powered minds doing that at the moment. So I was privileged to be at a meeting of leading American engineering academics, about 50 or 60. The idea of the meeting was to talk about future issues in engineering education. But the question that was being debated at the time is, well, what is the value of engineering? What is it that engineers actually do that contributes value? And I was really startled. I was really quite shocked because the best they could come up with is inventing new iPads and iPhones.
For God's sake. And say these are lecturers themselves? Like these?
These are very senior professors. Oh, now, I had the benefit of having thought about these issues. So I don't want to, you know, criticize their intelligence or anything like that. It illustrates the frame of mind that is prevalent within many circles in engineering, that they too were unable to spot the fact that they would never have got to this meeting if it were not for an entire aviation industry. They wouldn't have been able to live there had it not been for water supply, sanitation, food, transport, logistics, all these things we take for granted, electric power and so on. You know, these things we all take for granted. We don't give it a moment's thought. And part of the reason for that is because a lot of engineering is done so well that we do take it for granted. So it's up to us as engineers to remind everybody that you shouldn't take it for granted. It's there because of us.
That's the whole moral of this podcast, honestly, is that to help society realize the importance of engineers. What are some of the solutions? How can we improve upon the value of engineers in society?
Well, the first is to get a good understanding of how engineers really do create value. Mm-hmm. And my colleague, Bill Williams, who's based in Portugal, we have written our material. It's open for debate. It's not the last word, I'm sure. So the lesson there is that engineers can learn more about how we create value right now and then explain that. It's quite difficult when you think about it to explain our value to society when we've only got half an idea of how we do it, how we create value ourselves. And what Bill and I have tried to do is to find a language to talk about it. So, for example, one of the least desirable areas of engineering for many is maintenance. As one engineer said to me, good engineers get out of maintenance as quickly as possible. And it's a real struggle for people involved in maintenance to actually explain to people that it is a really valuable activity. So I don't talk about it in terms of value creation. What I talk about is value protection. So if you think about a water supply, for example, a city water supply, let's take Sydney, for example. What would be the consequence of that water supply failing?
Maybe catastrophic. Right?
Yeah.
Within literally a few days, Sydney would be uninhabitable.
Yep.
You know, this happened in Chennai. In Chennai in India, this just happened a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Well, they lost their water.
Yes, the water supply stopped. And there's lots of discussion as to why. And I think the general agreement is that the water supply was not properly managed. But you can't blame that just on the engineers. In fact, I've written about water supply engineers in India. It nearly happened in Cape Town a year or two ago. So this is not unimaginable. And so that job of maintaining a city water supply is not just maintaining the value of some pipelines, valves, and control systems and dams. It's about the value of that entire city and that human civilization that's built on it. That's an enormous responsibility. And engineers can start with that idea and say, well, look, we're all about protecting that value that's been accumulated over hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years, which would be lost within a short time without the work we do.
Yeah, I'm thinking about our trip to Warragamba Dam with the kids, and they have videos of the engineers walking through and checking this and checking that and pointing out, look at there, that's, you know, we need to fix that, or things like that. So the maintenance side of things, and then what you were just saying is like, well, if that broke, or if we stopped getting water from Warragamba Dam, for instance, not because it's dried out, but because of an engineering situation, then that would be slightly catastrophic.
It would be very catastrophic.
Because well, it's not only Sydney comes from, gets water from other locations.
It does, but it's also, it's not just, because when you think about it, it's not just drinking water supply as well. That you're talking about our telecommunication networks that go down, all the data centers would be gone after, you know, they've only got water storages for a finite period of time as well. So you don't really think about all the other things that it takes out that completely renders all of your buildings in the city as useless, because all the air conditioning systems won't work if they don't have.
This is just one example that James gave. Yeah. This is just one example, like the water supply. What if you knock out something happens to the water supply because you don't maintain that? The service. So,
and tourism's gone because all your hotels have all of a sudden been knocked out. So
That's the story. Like, yeah,
that's
the value. That's where you kind of start seeing the value.
Well, just on that, that sort of ties into what are your thoughts on the future of engineering?
Well, human civilization will not survive without us. Now, all right, I'm being presumptuous because my son, who's a lawyer, would say, well, humans won't survive without lawyers either. But I think that we need to be more open and helpful in helping everybody understand why engineering is so crucial in order to attract the best young minds. That's really what it takes. You know, we really need very bright young people. We have some staggeringly difficult challenges ahead of us over the next 30 or 40 years to move from a almost completely unsustainable global civilization. We are rapidly confronting the limits of what this planet can support. And within a very short time, we need to be in a position where we're working well within those limits, or else we're not going to survive. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
We have to transform everything, and I mean everything. We just have to transform the entire way we run this world, this planet, the systems in it. And we face a tall order because most people are not going to be very supportive if their lifestyles are seriously compromised.
Yeah.
Either by the solutions we come up with, forcing them to change their behavior, or because we fail at the task. And that's going to create an awful lot more problems. Yeah. So we have to find ways to support people everywhere. And that means, you know, the real solutions to sustainability need to work in countries like India, Pakistan, Indonesia, and China. These issues are not going to be solved in Australia or even the US. We have to solve these issues in these large countries with huge populations. And the great thing is that they're huge markets. So if we get it right, we create great businesses, which are going to make a lot of engineers very excited, very highly rewarded, and they're going to have great careers, great times doing this. And that's why I'd encourage, you know, everyone who's really got an eye on the future and saying, I want to do something about making the world a better place, get into engineering right now.
So what would you say to people who are already in engineering? What advice would you give them?
This is the greatest opportunity for engineers in centuries. This requirement, we've got to get to zero emissions in 30 years or so. The world is desperate for solutions. Pity the politicians. Because the politicians need answers, and we as engineers have not been terribly good at presenting possibilities to them. We've got to get better and quickly. But it's a huge opportunity because if we get it right, and I'm sure we can, and I'd like to think that our little air conditioning company is one way we can tackle this problem. By getting it right, we create huge opportunities, not only for ourselves, but for lots of other people as well.
Yeah, it's that from something small and that could potentially have global appeal or global applications that makes such a massive difference.
You know, there are literally hundreds of millions of people who are underemployed around the world. They would love to be getting their hands dirty doing these things. They just don't know what to do. Mm. It's up to us as engineers to show them what needs to be done.
Just to sort of wrap it all up, what's a piece of engineering that impresses you?
I would have to say C.Y. O'Connor, Charles O'Connor. He's one of my engineering heroes. He was sought out by John Forrest, who was the Premier of Western Australia, to construct Fremantle Harbour and the Goldfields water pipeline. Just looking at the pipeline alone, just imagine this. At the time, the longest water pipeline in the world was 100 kilometres. It was from the English Lake District to Manchester, supplying drinking water for that city. And it had a diameter of 20 centimetres.
Right.
O'Connor proposed building a pipeline that was 600 kilometres long with four times the diameter, right? And doing it at the point that was probably furthest from any center of engineering expertise in the world, Western Australia at that time, was really struggling. It was a place with 25,000 people. That's a small country town in Australia today. Now, he pulled it off. He had no maps to begin with, and he estimated the cost of the project and brought the project in. Well, the project was completed after his suicide, which is quite known about. After his suicide, the project was built, was brought in working at a cost overrun of less than 8%.
Oh, wow.
Right. Wow.
Now, it was a year late, but most of that was caused by a totally unexpected geological condition under the main storage dam. And, you know, there were additional delays in trying to get funding for it. So there were lots of criticism at the time, but you know, in today's terms, that is an amazingly skillfully executed project. There are very few engineering projects that perform as well, have lasted as long, and were brought in at only 8% over the original budget, for which there was no map provided.
Yeah, that's amazing. It is. Yeah, there's a statue, isn't there, in Perth?
There is a statue, and you know, perversely, even though his suicide was a tragedy, it is thanks to his suicide that we know so much about how he did it, and we can learn so much from that.
Why? Sorry, do you want to, how?
Because of his suicide, a lot of people have written about what he did, how he did it, and the circumstances at the time. And so we have that wealth of knowledge. You know, normally, there's this great thing, you know, you must have wondered, how did the engineers build the pyramids in ancient Egypt? Well, we don't know, because the engineers were no more inclined to write down how they did it then than they are today.
Very true.
Yeah, you know, you get a bunch of engineering documents. They only describe the finished object. They don't tell you how you get there most of the time. That's all implicit knowledge that we carry around in our heads. So the fact that so much has been written about, if you like, the not real engineering, the apparently non-technical stuff that O'Connor did, how he actually managed to get the project to run. There's a great book by Tony Evans that goes into the work he did in great detail. And, you know, if you're an engineer, you can read between the lines of a biographer and get a real understanding of really what he did. And the fascinating thing is that, in a sense, he did it well, but in essence, he didn't do anything terribly different from what engineers do today.
I would not recommend. I would not recommend people, though, to take his course of actions, and instead, you know, maybe write it down.
Well, exactly. Yeah, learn from what he did and make your life less stressful.
That's
definitely
right. Like, you know,
we could learn from that experience.
Such an amazing engineer. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. That was wonderful.
That's a pleasure. Being fun to talk with you, and I look forward to meeting you too as well.
And thank you for tuning in to another episode of Engineering Heroes. I hope you're enjoying our World Engineering Convention mini-series. This was our last episode of the series. If you're going to be at the convention, please come and visit us. I will also include on our website the time of all our special guests so you can see them live and in person. If you want to know more about our podcast and what we're up to, such as Melbourne, your best port of call will always be our website. Visit www.engineeringheroes.com.au and take some time to check out what we have going on. Thank you so much for listening today. If you really enjoyed today's show, your best way to show your support is go and tell someone. We look forward to you and your friends joining us next week when we bring you another interview with one of our engineering champions.